What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Knut Van Hoorn is the author of Bitcoin books, Sovereignty Through Mathematics and Independence Reimagined, as well as several notable pieces, including Bitcoin and Thermodynamics, Bitcoin and the Separation of Money and State, and Everything There Is Divided by 21 Million. Welcome back to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast, Knut Van Hoorn. How are you?
Thanks a lot. It's nice to be back. I'm fine, thank you. I hope you're doing well too.
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good during these crazy times. I find myself a bit bored these days with, you know, $55,000 Bitcoin in a lot of ways. It's strange. I mean, it's in some regards beyond my wildest dreams, because you're watching, you know, something that you kind of knew would happen, and you couldn't like kind of say it was going to happen until it became a thing. And I think it's already done just a numerous things for the world. Yet at the same time, I still feel like we're in the first round of like a heavyweight boxing match. But like that took us like 10 or 12 years to get to. And, you know, the whole crowd is against, you know, the new contender. And, you know, it's sort of like maybe, you know, you found, you know, maybe you've been coaching this boxer for like 10 years. You found them at 15 years old. You fed them the right nutrition, the right science, the right strategy. And you've been going through the whole circuit for 10 years and just annihilating opponents everywhere. And now here you are back at like, you know, not back, but now you're at the title fight, but it's so early and no one in the house believes anything you've experienced.
Yeah, I can relate to that. But this is not the title fight, though. There's still a long way to go. And this thing never ends. This is hyper-Bitcoinization, and we're living through it as we speak. This is how it will play out, the way it will play out. And apparently, April 2021 is Bitcoin is around $55,000. And so get them while they're still cheap.
I think it's enormously cheap. I feel like we're at 5,000.
Yeah, it feels exactly the same.
Yeah, and I feel like in some regards, just in terms of mind share or the recognition that something's going on here has just not broken through that much more in the last 6 months. And I thought that's what I kind of mean by back to square one. I thought this kind of like progression or progress would kind of pierce a lot of bubbles.
Well, I think it has broken through for a lot of people on a personal level, but this is not a, while it is a collective thing in one sense, it's not a collective collectivist thought in any shape or form. It's about individuality, and it's about freedom of expression and being yourself and empowering the individual. So maybe that's why like mainstream media and stuff seems to be ignoring it so much. There's a connection there somewhere. It doesn't really, like you say, it doesn't really feel like $55,000. I had a thought earlier today. I thought I'd lay it out here. Like the internet, when it came, it's like when you realize what it was, it was like anything that had to do with information was now shareable among everyone on the planet. You could share anything that could be like boiled down to ones and zeros. And in the beginning, that was just text and numbers. And then it became like audio and video and like pictures before that, but then audio as well and video as well. And nowadays we can do anything on the internet, like, and share whatever. And in 2009, when Bitcoin came, the internet evolved into a massively multiplayer online role-playing game where there's a game token that can actually bring you immense value in the physical realm. So Bitcoin is the thing that connected the digital realm to the physical realm in a very real sense that weren't there before. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't think we've ever had such a bridge into the digital realm. And that's a whole other, rabbit hole that's hard to get my head around. And it's like, well, the digital realm is going to replicate the physical world or meet space. And what does that mean in actuality 30, 40, 50 years from now?
Yeah, but this is the other way around. This is Bitcoin is like the real world is you get the value from the Bitcoin in the real world. So it's in a sense, they're more real in the virtual world than in the real world. But like the reality aspect of it comes from the internet and not from the outside world and into the internet, but the other way around. And I believe that's the first, like something born out of the internet is taking hold of the physical world outside it. And this is a whole new rabbit hole. I just got this idea today, and it's just a seed at this point.
Yeah.
But there's something really sci-fi about that, about something coming alive on the internet and grabbing a hold of the world outside.
Yeah, and I also see it as the inverse of the way I was looking at it, where code from the internet becomes law in the real world.
Yeah.
And then continues to push its own agenda onto the real world. And that makes me wonder whether, Bitcoin is coming alive or is really, sort of the machines driving us towards us engineering ourselves into benefiting them. Because this becomes, machine money and sort of like all those notions that you were kind of getting at with sort of that inverse reality.
Yeah, but Bitcoin is like the antidote to artificial intelligence in a sense, because it's the anti agenda money, where, well, of course, you can pay people to do stuff and you can become immensely wealthy by just hodling Bitcoin long enough. So in that way, you can forward your agenda, but there's no man behind the curtain. There's no man to behind the curtain to not pay attention to.
Right.
so that's what differentiates it from other types of money.
Yeah, I think what I was getting at before, with terms of price being at 55,000, thinking more people would reckon with this, is that I'm still waiting for a lot more people in my real life to see this as more than just money or a way to make money, but as a way to change the way we be and the way we are. And I wonder at what price, because I'm not so sure, Fidelity rolling out an ETF or who's the other one? Guggenheim coming out with a $400,000 to $600,000 valuation really changes the paradigm or the thought around what Bitcoin can do for humans and civilization versus what it can do for, large scale institutions.
Yeah, I've noticed that too. It seems like, of course, people talk a lot more about Bitcoin to me now that the price is high comparatively to what it has been. So there's a new buzz going on, definitely. But it feels like people are in the mindset that we maximalists were back in 2017 or even 2014, because they're still in the crypto mindset, or even if they're getting out of that and like, all the other cryptos are crap and Bitcoin is the thing, they haven't really, they see Bitcoin as a more legit version of the wider crypto ecosystem or something mm-hmm. like that. But yep. they don't see the big shift happening here. They don't see that this is coming from somewhere, and it's not from a huge corporation or a huge government or anything like that. It's people like rising up and defending themselves against manipulation, basically. And they don't see the big shift that is happening we Bitcoiners, we spell it out to them all the time, like we're never selling and we're only accumulating. We're not here to make mad gains and buy a Lambo. We're here to for everything else, for for feeling like my Bitcoin. I use my Bitcoin every day by not doing anything with them, but by just being aware of them. They make that helps me be more self-aware. It helps me in all sorts of psychological ways. I can express myself better. I can like argue for my position better, and I can like do all sorts of things more easily than before by just knowing that I'm on the right side of history.
Yeah. Going back a little bit earlier where you talked about the internet, it's interesting. I got an Apple IIc, or my mom did, when I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I would just hack away little like weird digital art. I remember bringing it into school and, you know, my teacher didn't even believe me that, hey, I could do this or that this was done on a computer. I mean, she had to come to my house, you know. And then in the 90s, you know, I'm on chat lines and America Online, you get those discs for free. And you could just already see the exponential growth of what's going on this platform and this network. And I remember in the late 90s, my father was like 55 years old at the time. He thought he was too old to learn a computer. And all he wanted to know was he found out about eBay and he wanted to sell things on eBay. And, it was just like this whole, it's kind of like teaching people about Bitcoin, but it was like, well, here's the on button. I don't want to know about the on button. I just want eBay. Well, to get to eBay, you need to turn the computer on. Okay, fine. Okay, now here's the internet browser. I don't want to be on the internet. I just want to be on eBay. Well, you see, Dad, eBay is on the internet. So you need to open the browser to, you know, and it was like, and now, you know, he runs a business. He's 80 years old. He runs a business on eBay. And, you know, he scans pictures and takes pictures and he does all the mailings. And you could just see the progression. And now it's just baked into life. He doesn't even remember that kind of conversation. We'll deny that even happened. and that's what I feel like I'm still in 1994 in that regard. And but I think things will happen way quicker because of the internet baked under it with those rails.
Yeah, of course. The network effect is already there in a sense. And yeah, I know that generation of boomers, there were quite a huge chunk of them said that they were really too old dogs to train. I mean, they never got computers. My mom still struggles with knowing what's on her computer and what's in the cloud and what a program is and like what a folder is. She can never really, I suspect she never really understood it. But then there was a part of that generation that just said, no, this is not for me. I'm too old to learn new things. But I would say a curious mind is never too old. Stay curious, because like the healthiest minds, old minds out there are curious minds that are eager to learn all their lives.
Yeah. My mom's 79 years young, and she does everything still on the computer. She's still very, you know, she kind of runs a newsletter for organizations that she's involved in. And she's studying the open rates and the link rates. And she's embedding links. And she just, if she doesn't know how to do something, she just goes to YouTube and figures it out and gets whatever she wants done. Yeah, it's kind of, it's
79?
Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Just plugging it away and hacking every system. There's a library 100 miles away where, if she goes to that library once a year, then she gets every book that they have access to free digitally. And then she gets to own those books in a way. So she just kind of figures everything out.
Excellent.
Yeah. I kind of want to turn to some of your latest work, the separation of money and state, and kind of the bigger topics that we were alluding to that Bitcoin is here for. And I'm kind of curious what would be like the belief system on a society on a Bitcoin standard?
I believe Bitcoin, the philosophical worldview that best describes Bitcoin is the one closest to Austrian economics, and that is objectivism, what Ayn Rand talks about a lot. And that is like, if you really approach life from an objectivist point of view and try to make rational decisions about real stuff, then you end up in the thought of Bitcoin, of course, because it's the most rational thing to hold on to, or like the most rational thing to invest in. So I've been listening to a lot of Ayn Rand lately, and look up objectivism and what that school of thought teaches, and I find it very, very nice. Like, there's a lot of Bitcoiners that are into Stoicism as well, from the thoughts of Marcus Aurelius, the old Roman emperor, and like more rationalistic worldviews are needed, I think. And I dislike the Jesus smuggling that is going on here and there in this space. But of course, I'm all pro that you are free to believe whatever you want. I just believe that what got me to Bitcoin is the rationality of it, and the trying to get out of the cult of fiat money is what led me here. So I believe the old system is more akin to a religious system than this system is. This is objectivism.
Do you think some of that old system is leaking into Bitcoin via religion? Is that kind of what you're alluding to with?
Not necessarily. I mean, the comparison between fiat, in a way, a lot of I know that the views on religion in America are very different from the views in Europe, and like the Americas were like the first secular states on earth, but pretty soon after in Europe the states became secular there as well. But then you have a thing in North America, which we don't have in the European countries, and that's that all the churches are tax exempt. Mm-hmm. So all the religious organizations in America are tax exempt, and companies are not, or other, like if you open a philosophy school or something in America, that's not tax exempt. But if you hold a religious sermon or like a course in Christianity, that could be tax exempt. So I believe that,
or college or university.
Yeah, exactly. So I believe your North American views on religion are skewed by that somewhat, and as a result of that, you have a higher percentage of believers or a lower percentage of atheists. And I believe this is very connected to why all your presidents have to say "God bless America" after every fucking sentence they say. So that thing never happens in Europe. Here, it's atheism is much more accepted in that sense. Well, this separation of money and state video I made, and I didn't make the video. I made the article, and Guys One read the article, and Yoni Appelberg made the video. So get things straight here. Follow those guys on Twitter, and subscribe to Yoni's YouTube channel. Now, where was I? The article. It's one of my more provocative pieces, I think, and but I felt I needed to tell that side of the story, like because I think the Jordan Peterson, Carl Jung crowd in Bitcoin has their narrative is like taking center stage. And I love many of these guys, like Breedlove, for instance. He's I really love his views on Bitcoin. And but what I dislike about it is the like Christianity as an antithesis to statism, which I don't believe it is, because my line of thought then statism is just another religion in my book, and just as collectivistic and just as bad and just as much of a belief system than any other religion. So I think this, or people organizing themselves in large numbers because they believe in a collective illusion, that's the danger. That's where the danger lies.
Yeah. I feel like I don't have a dog in the fight, in the sense that, like, I was raised, or I think I'm secular, and I don't like labels of any kind for myself or anyone, but secular in the notion that I wasn't raised in a religious household. Yeah. But what, you know, and what I'm trying to get at here is I do find this conversation on both sides very interesting. And I find that the conversation in the middle would be fascinating.
Yeah, I do too.
And so I kind of want to build a bridge in that regard. But I kind of want to stick to, you know, I kind of want to learn more about the other side that I kind of want to learn about this perspective that you're getting at. And so what is, like, America or the West or the Americas as a secular state, maybe in regards to the ideas of John Locke, and what are those ideas?
Well, those are, as I explain it in the video, that's like before there were civilizations at all, or before there were nation states, when we lived in tribes, humans lived in tribes and walked a lot across the earth and caught a mammoth here and there. when we did that, we had our tribes or little bands or groups were very seldomly exceeded Dunbar's number, which is how many people you can remember in your head and like how many people you can know at the same time. And it's about 160 persons or individuals. And this is like the size of a flock of baboons or chimpanzees. They usually don't exceed that number either. This is something that Yuval Noah Harari talks about a lot as well, like the intersubjective thoughts and intersubjective truths. There's like the objective world and there's our subjective feelings and thoughts, but there's something in between there, which is our intersubjective beliefs. And we need those to order ourselves, like to form bigger tribes than 160 individuals. And the first step towards that was like belief in a higher power. Because as soon as belief in a higher power was invented or discovered or whatever you may call it, leaders of human tribes, like the alpha males, the silverback gorillas, so to speak, were able to make people do things for them by referencing this higher power, and this is what this higher power wants. And especially with ceremonial burial, you can see historically how civilizations become much larger after they invent ceremonial burial. This happens with every civilization that invents that becomes larger at a fast pace at that point in history. And why does that happen? It's because you can tell your younglings or like your 18-year-olds that if you go to war with this other tribe here on the other side of the hill and kill them all, you will come to heaven and have like 16 virgins or whatever. The promise of an afterlife can make people do the most atrocious things to each other. And like, this is how war started, like large scale war. This is how I view this. The connection to statism and to especially to central banking is like, yeah, there were higher powers that could make people do kill each other, and they're like, we formed nation states, and nationalism and patriotism became a sort of religion in itself. Like, I'm doing this for the greater good of the country, and so on. But after that came central banking, which could give you a promise of a better life here and now in this life, not only in the afterlife, but here and now in this life. And that's how I view the promise of a better life here and now, because of an ever-increasing price of your house, an ever-increasing salary, ever-increasing whatever, to be the lie that the leaders of today use in order to subdue people and to keep us, not make us go to war with each other, but at least we're good little puppets.
Yeah.
By believing in this religion instead of the other. And how this ties into John Locke is like, secularism was sort of invented in order to get the different religious groups of that came from Europe and banded together in North America to like these ideas got into the Declaration of Independence, and the founding fathers, John Locke had a huge influence on them, because it had to do with the other thoughts of freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, property rights, and so on, like the freedom to exercise whatever religious ritual or belief you have is a huge part of that, including the no religion at all. And so that's the ideas that are baked into to the Declaration of Independence, which explicitly says that the government shall make no law prohibiting any sort of religious expression.
Right. I struggle with like sort of describing myself in this notion, but I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. I think, you know, in the sense of being secular, I think, you know, in the house I grew up in, we wanted to be assimilated and we wanted to be a part of those American dreams, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, life, liberty, happiness. And I think there was some sense of if we were, you know, like, because we're Jewish and I love being Jewish, especially culturally. And there's a lot of things about religion, about the religion or the history, the tradition, and some that I enjoy, I partake in. But we're not, I don't do things ceremoniously too often. And I do them kind of by choice. But there were periods in my life where I really questioned everything. And I was very confounded by, am I questioning, you know, being a Jew because I was born a Jew, you know, and therefore would I question, you know, anything I was born? And I think I ran from sort of like that self-identity for a while. And what I'm kind of getting at here is I'd like for you to kind of, what is atheism, or what is it to be an atheist in the regard that we're talking about? Because I know that's probably, you can kind of define that in different ways, maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Thank you for that question, because this is the question I was hoping for, because this is so misunderstood, the definition of atheism. And like, atheism is just the lack of a belief in theistic ideas, and it's nothing more and nothing less. So maybe people often confuse this with agnosticism. And agnosticism is saying that you're not sure if there is a God or not. And
that's why I used to call myself in my 20s.
Yes. And so that's like, there's a 50% chance to one way or the other. That's mainly agnosticism in my definition of these words. But atheism is not the militant view that there is no God, and there is absolutely no God, and this is not. That's not exactly the point. Like, the point is, the burden of proof is on the person making the claim. So if I claim there's a tooth fairy, the burden of proof is on me. Like, I have to prove to you that there's a tooth fairy. Otherwise, you won't believe in the tooth fairy. And for me, being an atheist, it's not a thing. There's no such thing as an a tooth fairyist, or an a Santa Clausist, or an a Mickey Mouseist. I mean, I just don't buy these ideas. I don't buy them at all. I find it like, I find the idea of a Boltzmann brain much more fascinating, for instance, if you know what that is.
No.
That is like an idea that preceded the idea, the simulation theory idea. And the idea of a Boltzmann brain is if the universe is infinitely large and there are infinitely many particles in it, then at some point in time somewhere, the particles will will just pop into existence or align or bash together in a way to form a human brain somewhere in out in space, existing for just a nanosecond, just long enough for thinking, what the hell am I doing here? And like a human brain, like your brain or my brain, the exact same particles that make up my brain or your brain will materialize somewhere in the universe and say, hey, what's going on, before just freezing to death and dying out in space. And not only that, but if the universe is truly infinite, this happens all the time to all brains. And that, this is where it gets really weird, because it's sort of like simulation theory. Are we living in the matrix, in the matrix, in the matrix, in the matrix? Because we might be living in an infinite regression of simulations of reality. And these graphics might be crap, actually. And there's a whole real reality out there with much better graphics than what we view as reality now. But the Boltzmann brain is sort of the predecessor to that thought. And I find these ideas very fascinating. I find the idea of like some entity having started the whole thing, or some entity giving a crap about what we do, to be just ignorant, to be honest. I mean, but back to you. You say you're Jewish. Well, do you identify as a Jew?
Strongly. Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I mean, I don't know what that means other than, you know, this, that's who I am. Yeah, like, do I identify as my name? Yeah, sure.
Do you identify as an American?
Well, I used to hide as a New Yorker. Okay. Even if I'm not in New York. Yeah. And that was a lot when, I mean, I don't think I think of it that way anymore. That was a joke when I used to, in my 20s, when I was traveling, especially outside of the U.S. or even in the U.S. when I was traveling. Because I do think, you know, the states are huge. And I think New York in particular, being especially downstate, now technically from the suburbs, but that's an island. And so, like, we're a little bit, like, I think a little bit different mentality, to be honest. And I would say vice versa. I'm sure someone from Texas would be like, hey, we're a little different from the people in New York. And even in New York, there's a lot of differences between regions. But to go where you're going, yes, I would say yes, check.
Because I find it fascinating. Of course, it ties into all the history with the Jews and all the horrible parts of that as well.
Yeah.
But I find Jews to a larger extent than Christians. Like I was raised sort of Christian. Well, I was never baptized because my parents didn't believe. That was sort of out of the norm back then in the 70s when I was born. That wasn't really normal to not baptize your kids. But we finished school, we had a sermon in the church, and like, I think I even attended Sunday school at some point, just because all the other kids did and stuff like that. So it wasn't, and of course, I've attended marriages and funerals and whatever, baptisms. So it's not like religion is completely out. It's not like I'm militantly fighting it every day with fangs and claws. That's not the thing. But I find it fascinating with Jews that they are mostly not as like all these superstitious notions about higher powers and beings and angels and stuff. That's not at all. I mean, it's much more common for Jews to actually be non-believers when you really ask them about their worldview.
So, well,
but then again, the you identify much more as a group than Christians do.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's sort of like, well, we're mixed, you know, and I try not to be a part of any group of more than probably four, which is my wife and two kids. Okay. I've never been part of a group. I think that was kind of maybe my struggle in my youth. I think.
Yeah, you know, but a group identity more, not a physical group, but like you identify.
I do. Yeah, I mean, I self-identify, and then I think I do see myself as part of probably a larger metaphysical group. And I think that's a weird thing and something I don't really think I intellectually believe in terms of tribes or nation states. But, you know, and I think there's also sort of like self-selection by, you know, how whatever you're born in, I think either run or run to it, run away, run to it. But, you know, I remember growing up thinking like, especially around the Iraq war in the early 90s, I was like 15, 14 years old. 12 years, I don't remember, but like, you know, there's a difference between like, yeah, I'm an American, and like the Jews in Israel have very different, they're Israelis. And in that regard, I was like, I'm not the same. I don't, you know, I want like my town to do well. I want my community to do well. And what our interests aren't always aligned. When, you know, on some issues, I think our issues are definitely always aligned as Jews in terms of whatever that tribally means. But I try not to act or move in tribes or identify myself as a group or being a label, just as an individual, okay. You know, and that's why, like, I don't feel like I have a dog in any of these fights, but I do have my own thoughts. Like, you know, so there are things that I do love about Judaism, but I'm not someone who practices Judaism. You know, there's
that. What are the things you love about it?
What are the things I love about it? Well, okay, like I've studied the Talmud, and I love the logical, we did just a lot of like studying of logic, and there would be these parables, and we would have to like kind of debate like what was right and wrong in this parable, what was the meaning of this story? And I love like trying to learn from like lessons from literally 99 generations. And there's some stories I love, like Masada and the Battle of Masada, and they'd rather die than not be free. You know, and I don't know if you know that story, or that's the version of the story I heard, you know, and the notion I took from
it. Is that from the Old Testament? I don't know.
I don't know if Masada is in the Old Testament, to be honest. But maybe from some other text. But, you know, I love that story. You know, I mean, there's more to it. But like, you know, like I was saying before, I don't know if I was born into something else, I'd probably find these other things that were beautiful and to love and things that were passed on. I think my whole rejection of religion is really on the organized, centralized front.
But that is, I would say that is mainly what I'm against too, like the collectivist mindset. But I go one step
and that's further. Anywhere. Like, yeah, I just don't want to be part of a group. I don't want to be labeled as anything.
That's why we're having this conversation now, because we're both like that, right? But I believe what I tried to do in that video, in the article, and that video is like take that argument a step further, because I think the idea is the bad seed that makes the collectivist thing so horrible and makes the cult so cultish in the long run, because it's the idea that's dangerous, and it's the idea that needs to be dissected and needs to be under scrutiny, however you may put it. Like, because, and that's not only the idea of an almighty God, but it's the idea of central banking, and it's the idea of Keynesianism, like inflationary currencies. That's just an idea that everyone takes for granted nowadays, and it's incredibly destructive to the entire planet. Like, we wouldn't have this environmental problem if people were thinking more long term, naturally, but we can't ever think long term as long as we have inflationary currencies, and most people are just. It's just too wild a thought for them to see. They can't see the parallel there between these things, and it's very depressing. But then again, life life was sort of depressing until Bitcoin happened. Not on a personal level. I mean, I had I've led a pretty good life. I've seen a lot, and I've had a somewhat successful career and everything, and healthy kids and a lovely wife and all I could dream of, really. But it's hard not to be cynical about the world when you see it for what it really is. It's hard not to be negative, and but Bitcoin is definitely a beacon of hope for those of us who love freedom and
I mean, I was definitely, I think, I don't know if I was depressed before Bitcoin. I'm born cynic, but I think my 20s were kind of I fought my depression, I think, or my cynicism and pessimism for the world by just trying to enjoy it for what it was. And sort of live that, I wouldn't say fiat lifestyle. It wasn't like I was a nihilist and going crazy, but I was just trying to, travel, enjoy myself, eat out, have interesting conversations, stay up late, not really, live for tomorrow, but just really. And I think that in my 30s, when I did meet, I was lucky to marry my wife and start a family and have everything I ever dreamed of. But life was still a rat race and very tough to, to kind of keep giving my family what I thought we needed. Because every time I thought I'd catch a breath, because of fiat, it would be harder to, now they're able enough for camp. Well, camp costs how much, and it was just, it was hard to be present because very strapped into just figuring out what needs to get done to get all those other things provided. And Bitcoin was sort of this real eye-opening, bright orange future where no matter, what little amount I had, I had control over it. And I could know, I knew what it was and no one could kind of mess with it. And I'm more talking about debasement at that notion. And no one could take it from me in case I wanted to vote with my feet. And it just, the idea of that was very freeing.
Yeah, and it makes you question so many things, what true ownership is and everything. And I think I think people aren't prepared for what's coming by a stretch, because the greatest shortcoming of the human brain is its inability to understand the exponential function. And the exponentiality in Bitcoin is the network effect. And that still very few humans that own Bitcoin. And when the tipping point happens and when the tsunami comes, that event will be so weird. And I think we might just be weeks away from it. And, considering MicroStrategy and everything Michael Saylor has said to all these higher ups everywhere after just accumulating, and he's all into the a finite number of tokens is the shit thinking, and scarcity is the thing here. There's nothing stopping this thing, and there's no replacement. There's nothing replacing it. There's no Bitcoin 2.0, and there will never be. This is it, and this is the shot we've got. And when people come to this realization, there's just no... I mean, us Bitcoins, we've been preaching this for a long time now, and sooner or later, the penny drops, and people will start getting it on a whole different scale than now, because the evidence is everywhere. The price is still going up, and it will continue to do so. And when people see that, it's even if they don't get why, and even if they don't get even if they can't comprehend the arguments surrounding it or stuff like that, they still have the price and the price history. I mean, it's pretty easy to look up the price history of Bitcoin. And you can just see that this is appreciating forever. And this will be more true for every year that passes. And like, to understand it. You can just observe it and come to that conclusion. And like, this in combination with like the halving coming up in less than 3 years now, right? Or is it 3 years? That's a bit more than 3 years. Maybe a bit more than 3 years. Yeah.
3 years and a month.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that.
Give or take block times.
Yeah. So when that happens, like the, and that's just one of many halvings to come. And people know this as well. Like, and we old school Bitcoiners, we've been living through halvings before. Like the, so we know what it feels like, and like they're barely noticeable until like some months after when the price starts doing weird things. And when that happens, like what is it now? There's like 1.5 minutes between each Bitcoin that comes into existence.
Sounds about right. Something
like that, right?
Yeah, more or less, give or take 15, 20 seconds.
Yeah, and it will be 3 minutes. After 3 years from now, it will be 3 minutes between each new Bitcoin. That's one new Bitcoin
right.
Every 3 minutes for 8 billion people to share. 8 billion. And it's not 8 billion people that are fighting over it, but it's 8 billion people's money that are fighting over it. Like, so it's all the wealth of all the 8 billion people fighting for these new Bitcoins that will be 3 minutes apart. 3 years from now, 7 years from now, they'll be 6 minutes apart. And 11 years from now, they will be 12 minutes apart. So it's really ridiculous that like the sat squeeze, the big crunch, whatever you may call it, like all the vectors point in the same direction. And we can't comprehend this. And this is happening at the same time as all the crashes in all the fiat systems, the big crash, the crash of the US dollar is coming. And like, what is it? 20% of the, or even 25% of all dollars that exist in the M2 mm-hmm. money supply were printed during last year. That's so weird. I mean, they're not in circulation yet. That's not how it works, but still sooner or later, that all turns into inflation.
Right.
And the real inflation rate is way higher than whatever indexes they put up on websites and news sites. Because all the money funnels into these scarce assets that are around the world, like property in Manhattan and property in London and stuff mm-hmm. like that, and fine art and Lamborghinis. Well, maybe not Lamborghinis, but you know. So, but there's some form of purge coming, and I just hope that the hyper Bitcoinization thing comes first, because we really, and like humanity has been in dire straits before this, and we've like before the East Bloc fell and before the Soviet Union fell, we all thought that everything would go to shit. The Cold War, no one who lived through the Cold War believed that it would end peacefully one day and one of the great powers of the world would just disintegrate and stop existing. No one saw that coming. And that's my hope for the future, that instead of this crash that is inevitably coming if you have inflationary currencies, they all go to shit at one point in time. That can be avoided by people just adopting this beautiful thing instead. And we can all live very wealthy lives and very rich lives without spending too much.
Right.
And it's just like, it's too good to be true. It's like eating the cake and having it too. Like at the same time as you're getting richer, you lose your urges to spend, and you lose your urges to be wasteful and like. And I hope this is how this thing works, like what an impact this thing has on other people's minds as well.
Right.
And I hope it's just not us, like, what would you call us? Like, thinkers? I don't know if I call myself a thinker or a philosopher. That sounds a bit smug, but whatever you may call it, like,
I think we're commoners who are witnessing revolution.
Yeah, we are.
You know, the war just, you know, like a civil war is not always declared. And I think we're just talking about the revolution at hand, but not everyone's aware of a war being fought. It's a small scale war right now.
Yeah.
I kind of want to turn back to, so, you know, the separation of money and state, and you know, 500 years ago, church and the state was not separated. And now we have quasi separation of church and state. And we talked a little bit about taxes, kind of blur that line. But what is the state, or who is the state now?
That's a good question. First of all, I wouldn't say that we have separated church and state yet, hardly anywhere, because like, for instance, here in secular Sweden, where 80% identify as atheist, we still have to pay taxes for our own gravestones. So we still, like, I don't want a gravestone. I think you can flush me down the toilet after I'm like dead and burned. I don't mind. I don't mind what happens to my remains at all. But we still have to pay tax, even though we don't have to pay church taxes anymore. We pay for our own burial via taxes, and so. So I don't believe very many states are truly secular. But what is the state? The state is the entity that produces bads in society as opposed to goods.
Right. Well, because I mean, you used to ask me if I was an American before. And, you know, it's interesting. It's like, you know, when I remember traveling in 2005 and I'd go to some countries where a lot of people were very mad at Americans after the election, and it's just they make assumptions about Americans as being all for the latest president, or all, you know, obviously because the president got in, so we, you know, and whether you're for or against any particular administration in the last 100 years, they're going to assume as an American you're probably for the current administration. And as a traveler, I didn't always want to be identified period, but less negatively maybe. You know, and it's interesting, like, who is the state? And I wonder, like, I think we were also kind of getting at maybe, like, is central banking the elites of today in the way the church was?
I guess so. That's the man behind the curtain.
Right.
But I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't think there are people, like, actually planning this out or like controlling the world, and I don't believe in a big puppet show, but I believe the incentives are aligned in such a way that it rewards certain behaviors. The system rewards certain very destructive behaviors, like virtue signaling, for instance. Like that basically came out of politicians first and spread onto social media. And that's like, it's very dishonest, all of it. And, but to your question, what is the state? I mean, I live in a country where people credit the state for almost all the stability that's been here for the last 300 years, because we haven't been in a war for 300 years. So the state gets a lot of credit here for everything good that happened in the country. But I view it differently. I think the state gets a lot more credit than they deserve for things that could have existed without them as well. people believe that things such as roads wouldn't exist without tax funding, and like there wouldn't be schools and there wouldn't be like healthcare or anything without taxes. And I just don't believe that's true. I think that if we take healthcare, for instance, I know that healthcare costs a lot more in the US, both total cost and the personal cost. And you have a totally commercialized healthcare system. But what people miss in this conversation between like universal or tax-funded healthcare and private healthcare is that the American system is not a good example of a free market system, because it's a fiat free market system.
And it's highly regulated and
yes, and regulated. The fiat thinking is all over it, because there's a lot of bullshittery and a lot of snake oil salesmen and a lot of stuff like that, and so it's a very fiat-y thing, the whole health that market in the U.S. and here in Europe, you have to. Like you have to really be sick in order for them to attend you at all, or to give a shit. And like, for instance, I had some problems with my intestines this fall. And
that was right before we talked the first time, I think.
Yeah, maybe it was. Yeah. And I've been to the thing is, I don't get one doctor. I've been bouncing around like a pinball machine between 3 different hospitals and like at least 10 different doctors at this point. So there's never one doctor that's on my case and taking care of me like that. I hear that a lot from people receiving healthcare in other countries, that they have a personal doctor that they go to and they have a relationship with a doctor. It's not at all like that here. Here you get bounced around between different doctors all the time. And to them, you're just a case on a paper, and there's never a personal relationship. And I think that's very sad.
Yeah.
And the administration costs a lot here. That's like 70% of the total cost. And it's a disaster in many ways.
Yeah.
But I believe healthcare is a disaster everywhere anyway, so.
I agree. I think it's a disaster here. My views on it have really grown over the years and changed. And but I don't think I really want to dissect the American healthcare racket too much. I'm kind of curious. I go through between 3 scenarios, because I think I love conspiracy theorists. I think I'm a conspiracy scientist. I'm going to look down. I mean, that's what I was searching for truth. I've always questioned everything. You can't tell me nothing. And it wasn't until I ran into Bitcoin where I couldn't refute anything. And I started to just run into arguments that I could not take down. And I just ran into full logic and truth. And that's why I do the show in a lot of ways, because I think talking to other Bitcoiners, I'm amazed. Well, if you found Bitcoin, what else have you found? Because I've been looking my whole life to find truth, and it's been really hard to find in this fiat world. But I really vacillate between, okay, so you kind of, the way you described it to me before is like the state to me, and the way you described it is like a network. Like Bitcoin is a network we built or discovered. I don't know whether it was, and I want to ask you that later. But so we have a network like Bitcoin. Well, you have a network that's just the world or just the state as is, and whatever is encumbered by it. And then I, you know, the next one is, well, you know, then there might be some entities who really know how to like manipulate and do things on this network at scale. Huh. And, you know, and then I go over to like, well, there's just a few people or 500 people who just really control the network and can do whatever they want with the network when they want, and can even run, you know, A and B testing and different things, and even go into different parts of the network and do A and B testing and do different things and see what works where. And I don't know which one is true. And I tumble between that, because like, there's just, well, maybe it's just individual actors all just doing what the system rationally incentivized them to do, even if it's mal. And then there's just like, well, there's people who understand there's a system here and they might be able to manipulate it. And then there's just like, well, there's some, you know, really elite people who control the system from top to bottom.
Yeah, interesting thoughts. I would say Bitcoin is a network in the sense that a language is a network of people speaking the language, which is beneficial to everyone who's everyone who learns a new language. It knowing the language is beneficial to them. So Bitcoin is it's just that, it's just a language. While the state is a network in the way a cancer is a network.
Interesting.
It grows and grows and grows, and some parts of the organism may actually benefit from the cancer being there short term, but not not long term.
Interesting.
maybe I'm being a bit harsh here, but if we're doing metaphors, that's the one that came to my head.
Well, I think in the current environment, like, I wonder, like, do you think, like, you know, the populations are going through like a psychop? You know,
a psychop?
Yeah. Do you think, like, or various psychops? Do you think states use the language of fiat and what that can empower them to do through media to manipulate or fool the people into submission?
Yeah, but I don't think there's a single person that thinks like, ha ha ha, I'm going to use this money printer in order to say this or in order to make people do this. I think there are central bankers, but I think their mindset is not about whatever benefits politicians or mass media gets from fiat, from money printing, it's like... it's a side effect rather than like the intention of the central banker. I believe the central banker just looks at a number every day and wants that number to be whatever his complicated equations tell him that it should be. And like, oh, I need to keep the inflation rate at 2.5%. And he doesn't care if house prices go up by 50% every year, because all he's looking at is the price of cheese. So I don't believe there's like a conspiracy in that way. I believe the incentives people have are aligned in such a way that there's this dishonesty in media and in politicians is a side effect of a larger problem.
What do you think that larger problem is?
That's fiat currencies.
Fiat, right?
Yeah.
And it's just a cancer in and of itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Got it.
And like, I believe it's going to get really weird now after this hilarious money printing during the I mean, there's a lot of debate about if COVID is a disease dangerous enough to be classified as a pandemic. There's a lot of debate about whether vaccinations are good things or not. There's a lot of debate about whether lockdowns are a good thing. There's a lot of debate about whether testing is a good thing. All of these things are debated. The only thing that you never hear about is the money printing that has been going completely fucking bonkers during last year. And that's what's going to have so much bigger impact than everything else.
What I can't get over is if I'm close to the money printing or I'm the source of the money printing, then I can buy my opinion in those debates. And I can drive larger narratives by choosing how that money gets doled out.
Yeah, and in a way you are closer to the money printing since you're...
As an American, I think that makes me part of the state. You know, because I think
every time you use fiat.
Right. Well, there are Americans, that are closer to me than the money spigot. But and then there are Americans that are less close. And then there, as a group, we're just closer to it than everyone in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
And one of the things, and I think it was Bitcoin Team that we said this in Clubhouse, but like, okay, what if we export all the inflation into Bitcoin?
Yeah,
and we being the state here, right? not me, not you, but
okay,
right? And Bitcoin goes up astronomically.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe it's relegated in the narrative for most people that that is something that is for the institutions or the people that have multi-general wealth, or, you know, it's too expensive, and they don't, and they never wake up. And so now you have, I think, a paradigm where Bitcoiners don't really change the world until they become the economic majority. And along that way, you're going to have the masses hate Bitcoiners, maybe.
Yeah.
Versus, you know, if like right now the masses were waking up and saying, well, you know, 5,000 to 50,000 is the same as 500 to 5,000 and $5 to 50. And then thinking about, well, what is going on here and what value is being captured? All they see is it's gone up, and either they think it's the top, or they think it's too risky, or it's for Goldman Sachs clients or Morgan Stanley clients. Could it be neutered that way?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question and a complicated question, but I think there's a point in the future where state level FOMO kicks in, because even though it's hard for states to own Bitcoin, because a state isn't a person, and like they would have to custody it somehow, and there's always risks with all that, and nation states aren't really good at doing IT.
Can a nation state actually own Bitcoin in some regards?
Yeah. I've been arguing about this in my book.
In terms of security, and I'm just saying, like, you know, would there be certain individuals within the state?
Yeah,
I know you're talking about multi-sig, but at some point, would some group within the group be able to take the Bitcoin from the state, and therefore it's not actually? Because if that happened, then it was never owned by the state.
I envision one of those, like in a Hollywood movie where there's a nuclear warhead and there's two big red keys and two guys needing to turn the keys at the same time.
Right.
And that would be like private keys, actual private keys that you need to turn them at the same. That's the multi-sig setup.
Yep.
You have one guy here and one guy in another state. Yes.
But then you'd have to have physical people keeping them apart, you know, and yeah, they can always go to another country together.
Exactly. And I've been thinking about this a lot, because the incentives are all there for them to just take the money and leave, right? So it's much harder for the...
Or spent.
Yeah. But for argument's sake, let's say that there's a way for nation states to store Bitcoin securely.
Sure.
So even though that whole part of the rabbit hole is very fascinating, and I've been down it several times before, let's just for sake of argument say that there's a secure level. And when that kicks in, that nation's leaders and that nation's central bank realizes that we need to accumulate as much of this as we can, as fast as we can. And we need to make it public as fast as we can, because that will drive the value up even further. Just like MicroStrategy did. They announced it publicly, and then the price.
So which country would be the MicroStrategy of states?
Yeah, this is the million sat question, right? Because...
more like the million Bitcoin question.
Yeah, but I say million sat because I think 20 years ahead.
Fair enough.
And then what they'll do is they start printing really absurdly fast. I mean, it's absurdly fast now, but they can print, like, since it's just numbers on a computer screen, they can, like, oh, right, here's a trillion, here's a trillion dollars, whatever. Like they can make that figure really absurd, and because they realize that they can only do that until the point where the sellers of that Bitcoin realize that this currency isn't worth shit anymore. So because they know they will kill their own currency in the same process.
Right.
So they need to really kill it and make it go out with a bang, so to speak. And then you have the state level prisoner's dilemma FOMO playing out. So you have the next state doing the same thing and bam, 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 bam. And it could be within weeks, all the other currencies could be dead. And this is so weird to think about, because like that we have a really short span of time to reorganize society in that case.
Yeah, like, you're talking about a cataclysmic event.
Sort of.
I mean,
because everything we do now is doable in Bitcoin too. It's just
100%.
Hard. Yes,
we don't even need more technology. I mean, you can zap Bitcoin around on PayPal.
Yeah, exactly.
Not that I would use PayPal ever, but like you can move it around just as fast as anything else on other rails.
And you can denominate them in $2,020 if that makes it easier for you or something.
Right.
So everything is easier to do except the coercion part, and except the everything that's coerced is harder to do. So every violent, it's harder to steal the Bitcoin. It's harder to tax the Bitcoiners. It's harder for customs to put whatever fees between countries, and it's harder for the coercion exchange that goes on in the world. It's harder for interventionism to happen. But still, we need to reorganize a lot of things, because a lot of things can't be state funded after that point. So I'm
wondering, you know, I'll stipulate Bitcoin's good for the environment. It's not going to boil the oceans. I'm not going to take you down that rabbit hole. But in terms of what Bitcoin can do in terms of being a mathematical battery and for civilization, and sort of what do you think of some of the benefits if Bitcoin were to create sort of new areas that we could congregate around because of transit energy?
Yeah, this is a whole other part of the rabbit hole. I recently wrote an article, a new article. I've written many articles about the Bitcoin and the environment, but the latest one is called Orange is the New Green, and it's in Citadel 21 magazine. It's about this concept of money as a battery. That's like, you can now, I mean, I kind of dislike using physics terms for monetary energy and stuff like that, but there is Bitcoin has sort of made it a bit easier to see that there's a point where the two worlds meet. So you can convert electrical energy into monetary energy. And monetary energy is human time. So what you're doing is you're converting, like if you have a hydro plant, you're converting, what's that called? Height energy, the energy from the height of the water, and then movement energy, like the water dropping down, and then the
waterfall.
A waterfall going into a turbine and driving the hydro plant. And then that gets converted into electrical energy, which then goes to a mining rig and gets converted into monetary energy, which is basically human time. And like, if you really think about it, all like every invention mankind ever came up with, every idea we ever had is there to save us time, save someone time somewhere. Every tool we ever invented, everything. Right. So a hydro plant is already saving us time, because it's harnessing energy from the outside world. And the most, the highest form of like energy, how it's connected to human time, the closest connection between energy and human time is monetary energy. So if you can convert electricity into human time directly, or like into Bitcoin, which is human time, the closest thing we have to human time, then that's an even better use case than electricity in a sense. So you could build power plants wherever you want. You don't even need to connect them to the electrical grid.
Right.
You can have a power plant off grid just
mining Bitcoin and just keeping them there, storing them on location. And the further off the location, the better it is, because it's harder for someone to sabotage it or steal the Bitcoin or whatever. So, and this could be like a 300-year operation or something. So all the long-term thinking incentives are there. And like that, we're just in the beginning of thinking about how this impacts the environment. But what I think it does is like what it does to everything else. It brings honesty back to the debate, because the debate now about what energy sources to use and global warming and anything is a lot of things, but it is dishonest. We subsidize green energy, and we ban nuclear energy for some moronic right. reason when it's much better for the environment. And so it's the debate about the climate and everything is dishonest, because we're not honest enough to see the problem for what it is. That we can't have sustainable societies with an ever increasing GDP. That's just not possible. We can't save the planet by consuming more. But then again, we can't advance society without consuming more energy. So we need to consume more energy without destroying the planet somehow. And how do we do that? Well, the first thing we need to rethink is the monetary system, because that's what's the underlying mechanism below everything else. So that's what we need to change. That's like change the monetary system first, and then all the environmental benefits comes after. And not only that, but Bitcoin mining in itself could be very environmentally friendly if you just give it some time to... give people time to actually build businesses around these ideas.
Yeah.
And you have Aker in Norway doing this, the big firm in Norway that bought Bitcoin.
Right.
They're actually connecting a Bitcoin mining rig to wind farm, and I believe to one of those where they have to burn off a lot of excess natural gas. That was also going to be connected to a mining rig somehow. I don't know if I'm right about this, but they have some plans for really environmentally friendly Bitcoin mining. And what I say in the Orange is the New Green article is like Bitcoin has just surpassed the energy use of Switzerland, or it's the same as the energy use of Switzerland per year. So we should ban Switzerland immediately.
That's funny. Well, I'm kind of getting that. And meanwhile, it's late April and it's snowing outside my house. What I'm trying to get at is not get at, but what really kind of I'm wondering if. So let's say you have these wind farms in Africa, which didn't really make sense because it would take a long time to get the energy from the wind farm to the grid in long term distance, and they would lose a lot of energy on the way. And therefore, yeah. It doesn't make sense either to extract that energy. No,
put solar panels instead. It's Africa.
Right, or even live there. But like with Bitcoin, could not only could we utilize and extract this off the grid energy or off the beaten path energy, but would civilization kind of sprout up around these places that we never could inhabit before, or did it make sense to economically inhabit?
I don't think so, and it doesn't need to happen that way. I mean, these places could be...
Would that be a positive byproduct? Would that make, real estate more affordable for more because we have more places that would make sense to live than in the past?
Yeah, but the thing is that it's sort of... The location of the power plant, you can put the power plant in a very remote area and you wouldn't need human settlements around it. That's sort of the whole point. You could build a solar plant covering like a tenth of the Sahara, and no one would have to live in the Sahara desert.
Right, but maybe somewhere more. I mean, maybe there are desirable places that we just haven't developed because of different reasons around energy, or around ports or lakes or whatever. I don't know, but.
Yeah, but that's sort of the thing we're moving away from as well, because you don't really need to be in the location where you extract the value or extract the
So
this is on the other hand, I think, like, I come from a small town in Sweden which used to be a there used to be a lot of shipping in that town, but it's in a lake in the Sweden's biggest lake. So, but then they cut off the harbor by building bridges across the river. So now there's a lot of less marine traffic going on in the town, and that's sort of fiat thinking as well, and like politicians not seeing the bigger picture, because if the country should ever like fall apart, and then you couldn't get stuff into the city by boat as easily. And if like the roads were cut off for some reason, then you've also cut off the waterways, and that's very bad in the long run. So I'm hoping that Bitcoin can bring back some more, that cities could be built around useful, like ports and what am I getting at here? That the cities would be built more in line with what you used to build them around, like waterways and like fertile ground and stuff like that. So you could have your local beef and you like
all the local goods. Makes sense.
Less Las Vegas and more more classic cities.
Yeah. I hear you.
Fewer Las Vegas, sis.
Fair enough. Have you been to Vegas?
No, I haven't. Not yet. I'm just hoping I can get to Miami in June.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about Biden's or about the ban on Europeans traveling to the US?
No, to be honest, the only time I hear about it is when the European Bitcoiners are interested and complain about not being able to get there. I don't follow the too much, but like, I don't know how things are progressing on the ground, but I hope you guys are able to get in.
I think it will be hard though, because I saw some news, some article from like a month ago where they said that they might lift the ban in mid-May, but I've heard nothing of it since. So but that would be really sad if we couldn't get over there.
Yeah, I mean, it's another demonstration of not being able to do what we want to do. And make your own decisions. And so I think it's a shame it's happening to us, the people that really value our freedom and the ability to do what we want to do.
Yeah, and it's sort of a shame that you have to become so shit rich that you can afford your own private jet in order to get anywhere in this world these days, you know. But that's what we're facing.
I think
that's honest.
Yeah, I mean, that's the writing on the wall. That's why I don't see, you know, people. When I say the masses, I'll include myself. I'm in the masses colloquially. Again, I don't put myself in, you know, but I'm not part of the elite. And it's like, yeah, the rich and the wealthy are still traveling. I've been traveling too. I don't, not because I'm rich and wealthy, but because I want to go see my parents. And I miss them. I'm going to go see them. It's my right.
I'm not traveling a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's crazy. I don't think that tide is turning on that at all. And I'm super bummed about Miami that we won't see you guys. I mean, you guys are a big part of the faction.
Well, you don't know yet. And maybe I could get one of those, like, maybe I could get another Bitcoiner to write me one of those I'm here for work letters.
Yeah, I'll do that. Why not? It'd be no big
deal. Yeah. I got a couple of offers already, but
I think I heard you talking about that on a show. I think so. But yeah, I mean, but it's a shame you have to go through these hoops and play these games, you know.
I think I have to go to the embassy in Stockholm and stand in a line for 5 hours and stuff like that in order for that to happen, even if I have the letter.
Right. Not only do they give you an avenue, but then it's like, we're going to make it as hard as possible in the 21st century.
Yeah.
You know, it's just amazing. And all that, I think, just speaks volumes to me and it always has. It's just, I never saw the state, you know, as being antagonistic until Bitcoin, but I never really understood what I was up against.
Oh, it's towards foreigners, it's antagonistic as hell. It's always been.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're kind of raised to like work with the state, and if you want to make change, to work within the state apparatus. And I'm not saying that I was looking to be of or in the state, but it's like you just don't think about it as an other. I didn't.
The U.S. is so big, so you can afford not to think about outsiders.
Right. There is some change where you can even go to different states or different cities or whatever. But one thing I want to ask you about is what is alien coin and could it surpass Bitcoin?
Oh, this is a debate I had a couple of months back. the premise is this, an alien coin is could anything ever replace Bitcoin? Well, imagine an alien species coming to Earth because we're worthy now that we've invented Bitcoin or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that they have a cryptocurrency of their own with which is provably more decentralized and with more proof of work and a longer chain and whatever. So basically a better Bitcoin with a longer history, a way longer history. It could be like, I mean, this is a galaxy spanning civilization. And would that thing replace Bitcoin? So it's a thought experiment basically. And, I believe, first of all, the hurdles and like the odds of that happening are so low that like even discussing this thing is weird. And would we start using the aliens' means of the aliens type of money? I don't think so. I mean, because we would be giving up our sovereignty as humans if we did. I don't even remember what I wrote in the article. but this is the alien coin attack vector. So, but that's the thing. In order to even think of a thing that would be better than Bitcoin, you have to think in these strange ways, and you have to really come up with weird scenarios to see something replacing it, because nothing can be invented or discovered on Earth. Like, what would that be if we discovered an ancient blockchain that the Aztec civilization had, or like, what would that be? Tutankhamun's grave in Egypt, and we found a blockchain here laying around that no one has been using for 5,000 years. It's ridiculous, right? So,
It's interesting, especially on the part where you say, like, I think you're game theorying it out, where like, would we use their coin if it was better? And that kind of makes me think of like nation states, though, and the way they're not going to use Bitcoin, even though Bitcoin's better, because it's kind of like they're giving up their sovereignty.
Exactly.
And that's the hitch, where they're just not going to come on board, even if it makes sense.
That would be a hell of a friendly alien race in order for us to give up our sovereignty for something better.
I think your article was inspired by a conversation between John Vallis and Reid Womack on John's show.
Exactly. This is Reid Womack's idea.
And I think your question to them, and I'll pose to you, is how do you know Satoshi wasn't an alien in the first place?
Oh, I wrote that?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have no way of knowing. So maybe that alien civilization... we're already here, and they
this is what they gave us.
Right. And what is an alien symbiote? It was in your article, Bitcoin and Venom.
Oh, symbiote.
About the move, the Venom movie starring Tom Hardy.
Yeah, that's also. Oh, where do you find all these old articles?
On your Medium blog.
Yeah, you're really doing some digging here. I hear. I haven't been writing a Medium article for an article on Medium for quite some time now. Because Medium got sort of
kind of annoying to deal with.
There was a lot of censorship going on there, I remember.
So I and you have access issues. I don't want to pay. And then,
yeah. Oh, we're on. Yeah, the alien coin thing there. Yeah. No, the Venom thing.
Yes.
Like Venom is an arch nemesis of Spider-Man. Like that's where the character came from, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I grew up with Spider-Man comics, and that's where Venom came from. And the whole premise of Venom is that it's really one of Spider-Man's suits, and but it's not a suit; it's a symbiote, however you pronounce that word.
Yeah,
that came from outer space that has a symbiotic relationship to its host, so it's a parasite, and it merges with this guy, and I really can't remember the connection I drew between the
So in the movie, Tom Hardy plays a reporter named Eddie Brock, and Eddie stumbles into a suspicious looking research facility and gets infected by an alien life form. And the
Did
alien
you see the movie?
No, I didn't see the movie, but I'm kind of wondering, like, what, you know, if you could explain what you were getting at here, and whether where's symbiotic with Bitcoin?
Symbiotic with Bitcoin, this is really in line with like Bitcoin changes you more than you can change Bitcoin, or way more, because you can't change Bitcoin at all. But Bitcoin will change you, and you will have a symbiotic relationship with Bitcoin, because Bitcoin can be viewed as a life form in itself as well. Mycelium is a popular metaphor. So you're basically living in symbiosis with this life form that feeds off your incentives.
Interesting. Do you think that Bitcoin's price curve will be shaped like an S shape, similar to most new technologies and communication networks, or something else?
Oh, did you see that video?
Yeah.
Yeah, I made a video in which I argue that its adoption curve or its price curve will be J-shaped rather than S-shaped, and that this will go on for quite some time. First of all, during the death of all the fiat currencies, when the only weapon they have left is printing more money at an ever-increasing rate. And that thing alone makes the price of Bitcoin J-shaped rather than S-shaped. But the thing is, it doesn't end there, because post hyper-Bitcoinization, when all the fiat currencies don't exist anymore, then we have a global sound money free market system, which is a very much more effective mechanism for pushing the prices of everything even lower at an even faster rate than now. So that, in combination with all the other new technologies with 3D printers and AIs and stuff, and like we're already approaching zero marginal costs for manufacturing and transporting goods, and so the purchasing power of Bitcoin will go up, and it will go up at an ever increasing rate. And I don't think this ever stops, because
it doesn't stop where there's no more money. It just keeps going, because when everything is denominated in Bitcoin, everything is much more well oiled. The whole machine is much more well oiled, and it just gets better at an ever increasing rate. So that's a very optimistic thought.
Yeah, I wonder if you think if volatility will ever decrease, and if Bitcoin will ever actually be used as a medium of exchange, if it really does go through a J curve.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm not sure if it ever will be used as a medium of exchange, but I don't think that's necessary.
Right.
I mean, of course it will be used as a medium. I'm confusing this with a unit of account. I'm not as sure about the unit of account part. That's the thing. Of course it will be a medium of exchange, but probably. And the Lightning Networks plays a huge role here, and it will be used for exchanging smaller things and even bigger things. But the real big things, like property in Manhattan and stuff like that, that will be done on-chain, probably.
With Bitcoin as a unit of account.
But what I'm questioning is if Bitcoin will ever be a good unit of account. Because even after all the fiat currencies have died, if you have a fixed supply, then like the volatility doesn't go away there, because the price of a bottle of milk, for instance, would fluctuate enormously,
drastically, all the time. I see what you're saying on the J shape. Wow. Okay, I interpreted your work as saying, you know, maybe it would never be medium exchange based on the J shape curve. But that I interpret a lot of your other work is that unit of account is the most important thing. And I think unit of account is the most important thing to me, the way I think about Bitcoin.
I contradict myself. I do. But
which is fine, you know.
But that's like, if I get a better idea, I discard the old idea and I try to evolve.
That's great. Like,
yeah.
But I really think it was interesting. Your ideas that I just recently read made me question whether it would be a medium of exchange. And I don't think that's even important per se to Bitcoin's future.
No, I don't think it's important at all.
But I think unit of account is the most important feature to me. At least in the current environment, in terms of, I think it makes me low time preference.
But no one uses it as a unit.
Well,
of
I do.
You do?
I do, and that's why I think it, like that's why I'm just perplexed.
When I look at a house, my
house just got way more expensive in Bitcoin terms. Not the house I'm living in. Like it would take me meaning it was it used to cost 50 Bitcoin for a house. Now it costs 5 Bitcoin for a house.
Yeah.
So now it's harder for me to get that kind of Bitcoin to buy a house. So I see how purchasing power is already inflated ridiculously with Bitcoin and deflated or decreased with my other, with fiat and my other units of account. But also in terms of like, when you were talking about like, what did Michael Jordan get paid? Well, it's like, well, in 1984, he got $30 million, but that would be worth $55 million now. Well, that's a ridiculous way to count money. So I'm starting to think of like, how much does that stove cost? Well, that's 100 satoshis, or that's a million satoshis, or whatever it is.
Yeah, but a money that does the complete opposite is also a ridiculous unit of account.
The dollar.
No. A money that does the complete opposite of what the dollar does, which is Bitcoin, is also ridiculous because you would be saying, oh, Michael Jordan made this and that many satoshis a year. That's worth this and that many satoshis now, because the satoshis will go up in value indefinitely, just as fiat goes down in value indefinitely. Because the way I view it is like the more expensive the money is to produce, like, no, I'll start from the other side. The cheaper the money is to produce in comparison to every other good and service, the more expensive every other good and service becomes.
Right.
And but the opposite of that is also true, which is the more expensive the money is to produce, the cheaper every good and service becomes in comparison to that money. And
right. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, and producing new Bitcoins gets more expensive over time, and this never ends. At the year 2140, it will be almost infinitely, past that point, it will be almost infinitely expensive to mint new Bitcoins. Because what you would have to do that is you would have to bribe enough people to run their nodes, sure, signaling that they would change the protocol and change the
a world where the price of a pencil goes down makes sense to me, or a world where a cost of an accountant goes down makes sense to me, because, you know, a world where, like, the cost of a pencil goes up, you're like, well, is the pencil better? Does it write better? Does it? Do you think, fine. Help.
Let me flesh this out, because it's important. Yeah. Okay. Because it doesn't help to compare it to the most deflationary good in society, just as it doesn't help to compare it with the year. It doesn't make sense to use that as a unit of account, just as it doesn't make sense to use the dollar as a unit of account, really, either. Just as you say, it's ridiculous to say that back in 1991 that would be as many millions as this amount of millions is today. The opposite would be true for Bitcoin, because Bitcoin's purchasing power goes up so incredibly fast, so it's even more ridiculous.
Right, but the underlying equation is 1 + 1 equals 1. So yeah, it's deflationary, but like you can make sense of it. Yeah, this costs less because we're better at making it.
Yeah, and
or we make it faster. It's
I think it may be useful as a unit of account for some time.
Well, what I'm getting at is like it makes sense that prices can change. But why should someone who's not as good as Michael Jordan be getting paid more? And then you have to explain, because we changed the underlying denominator in the unit we're paying this newer, less talented player. You know, like I was explaining to my mom was a teacher, really great teacher. At the height of her career, let's say she's making, you know, X dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then now someone who's at the beginning of their career is making 5X dollars. And I'm getting less experience for the student. The student is not getting more for their money.
I totally agree. That's really weird, and that shouldn't be. But let me take you back to the beginning.
It's interesting what you're saying. Yeah.
The beginning of this interview, you said the price of Bitcoin is $55,000.
Yes.
What you should have said is like the price of a dollar is 1,600 sats or whatever.
Correct. It is. Fair enough. Like,
So you're not really using it as a unit of account.
Well, I was speaking to maybe the other people who don't use it as a unit of account.
okay then. Fair enough.
But I hear you. I try to speak in sats as much as possible.
Yeah.
That's even more than Bitcoin, just so that we get away from unit price bias.
Yeah. I think though, switching from a fiat, a very late stages of fiat capitalism, fiat monetary system, to a Austrian economics even better than gold monetary standard, or infinitely better than gold, actually. So that requires quite a rethink of everything. And in a transition period, I believe Bitcoin would be a very good unit of account, just as you say, as like your mindset now in thinking of the value of your house in Bitcoin terms, like, oh, Bitcoin is a better investment than my house is and stuff like that. So in an intermediate period, it will be a very useful unit of account. But when this state level FOMO and everything kicks in and it gets really fucking weird and we have to rethink everything, which is a point that inevitably comes at some point in time, then like cows might be a better unit of account, or
right.
or gold, or whatever, some other denominator that is.
Well, I heard a really weird argument on Bitcoin Clubhouse the other day.
Okay.
So this person was arguing, it was a Bitcoin maxi. But they were arguing, this was a very strange argument. They were arguing that, let's say 30 years go by, we're still transitioning from Bitcoin to, from the US dollar to Bitcoin. And in 30 years, Dogecoin will have lower inflation than the dollar. And that we'll need a bridge still from fiat to Bitcoin. Because Bitcoin is deflationary, no one would want to loan in it. No one's going to want to count in it. And you might have to work your whole life to get a Satoshi at that point. And that maybe no one's using it as a literal medium exchange because it's so astronomically going up.
Yeah.
That society needs a currency for the common person to do loans and transactions in that's not deflationary, but not as inflationary as centrally state-controlled money.
This is what I'm talking about, because if we use, like, Bitcoin used to be the standard for those people, like, using it as a unit of account a couple of years back, and now that's useless, and we use Satoshis instead, and Satoshis will also be useless at one point in time, and probably sooner than we think, and we will have to talk millisats and stuff like that, so we'll have to change the unit of account a lot.
I hear you. I'm going to read you back before my final question. The excitement of us so-called Bitcoin maximalists is not primarily because of the enormous gains that the maximalist attitude has granted to those of us that hopped onto the freight train early enough have been blessed with. Nor is it because we're in it for the technology, which opponents of the viewpoint often sarcastically accuse us of claiming that it is. Those of us that preach the near divinity of this invention do so primarily because we see the philosophical impacts of absolute scarcity in a commodity. The idea of a functioning solution to the double spending problem in computerized money is too great an achievement of humanity to be ignored. The world-changing potential of this invention cannot be understated, not in the long run. The more you think about it, the more the thought won't give you any peace of mind. If this experiment works, if it's real, it will take civilization to the next level. What we don't know is how long will it take? So my last question is, how long will it take?
It will happen sooner than you think.
It's very interesting. You've kind of been kind of really kind of getting at that or alluding to that. Things, I mean, gradually then suddenly. I'm starting to really feel like maybe things will just take a lot longer than we think. And again, not in terms of price action. I just don't know, you know, when things change culturally, the mindset changes, when people shift to thinking in Bitcoin, even in the short term.
Yeah, that might take a while. But then again, the number go up technology is the more, in a way, the most important aspect of this.
It is. It really is because nothing else speaks to people. Honestly, because you can talk to them about a lot of different things, but that's what's going to click in terms of, yes, that person's right.
What we were talking about before, about like the travel restrictions, that's, the weird thing is that there's a point here, there's an actual point where we not only can, but need to buy a private jet to go to the US. Because the old system won't be there for us anymore.
Right.
So you see where I'm getting at? This sovereignty we keep talking about, it only comes from becoming shit rich.
Right.
In fiat terms. That's the name of the game here. And that might sound horrible, but it's the only way out of slavery.
Yeah, in a way. I really hope everyone comes along for the ride.
Yeah, as many as possible, at least.
Right, and it gets as more individuals get less rich individually because they, you know, more people buy Bitcoin, you can have a little less. But yeah, then more of your family, your cousins, your friends, partake for themselves rather than a few individuals trying to get build a large enough life raft for everyone. Just because, not from a selfish perspective, but from an awakening perspective.
Yeah, an altruistic perspective. Like, I just hope as many normal people as possible are able to front run all the, or leapfrog all the, no, front run is the word. The leapfrog is another. Front run all the nation states and all the corporations now before, like.
That's why I got so mad at Elon. Yeah. I got so mad at Elon Musk because he was, you know, pumping Dogecoin. And it's like, you have an opportunity to help people here.
Yeah, but he's just trolling, right?
It's just trolling, but it's at people's future lives are at expense.
I can understand that, and
they're gonna get Bitcoin at the price they deserve, and I understand.
But if you don't get that Dogecoin is a joke,
I get it.
Maybe you deserve it. Like,
and maybe that's the first touch, and they make money on Dogecoin, and they get destroyed in Dogecoin,
if you even do a tiny bit of research. Yeah, no, but like just do a tiny bit of research into Dogecoin and you can see that the inventor of it explicitly said that.
I know, but the people he's speaking to are not going to do that work, and that's to their own detriment. I get that.
Yeah, but then it's a valuable lesson. It is a valuable lesson to them. People need to just not follow, like. We're so now this ties into the beginning of the conversation with the secularization thing and the like, because that's the problem with people. They think that they need to follow a thought leader of some kind, and they're afraid to think for themselves. And this is the problem. And in that sense, I think that Elon Musk should promote Dogecoin as much as he likes, because the only way for people to learn is through their own mistakes.
Well, I agree. He should do it as much as he likes, but I don't know why he likes pumping a shit coin and when he could have an opportunity to do something more altruistic.
Yeah, it's a weird perverted sense of humor. I give you that, but and it's not something.
And it makes me question the other things he's doing with the technology in his company. Because I like being on the forefront of technology. I want technology to do great things in the world. But if one of the people who are the greatest technologists in the world is going to fuck around with people, for some sits and giggles, it's like, well, I don't know what's going on with it. That's why I like not having to buy stocks, and I like having Bitcoin, and I like not having to have my future tied to Tesla stock. But
he gave away. He sold a flamethrower at one point as well, right? With the Boring Company.
Okay.
Did you see that?
No, I don't remember.
So, like, he does all sorts of weird shit.
Yes, he does, which is great. Which makes me think maybe again questions the actual engineering and technology, or is it more marketing? You know, because he seems like a great salesman too.
Well, he's a great technologist, but he's a really great salesman. I mean, a Tesla. If you buy a Tesla, you have it for 5 years. You need to change the battery, and that costs like 75% of the whole car, right?
Wow.
So it's weird.
Do you think we're going to be able to buy Tesla for one Bitcoin one day?
For one Bitcoin, that's too high.
Fair enough. So in that scenario, is that because Tesla had to divest over time of their current Bitcoin holdings?
Well, you can buy a Tesla for
Bitcoin. No, I meant the whole company.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I said that at some point, right?
Yeah.
That was a tweet. At one point in time, someone will buy the entire Tesla company for one Bitcoin. Yeah. What led me to this was like Bitcoin has, and this is very long-term thinking, and like Bitcoin has more longevity than Tesla does. That's the basic argument. And all Bitcoins will be, at one point in time, there will only be one Bitcoin left because all the others would have been, all the keys are lost or whatever, or boating accidents everywhere. Like, there is a point in time where this ends. Since they're finite, there's an end point. And that's the point I was trying to make. And I think I talked with Jeff Booth about this.
Mm-hmm.
Or someone like that, and they didn't agree. Like, no, Tesla has a shit ton of Bitcoin. They will keep them forever.
This is where I heard you discussing this. Yeah, tweet that you put up, and then further discussing it.
And my point is that since Bitcoins are finite, there's an end point to them. and there's a point in time where there's only one Bitcoin left. And if there's only one Bitcoin left, that Bitcoin will definitely buy you the Tesla company at that point in time, right, if they even exist, which I don't believe they will. I mean, companies pop up and die all the time. And Tesla might be here for 500 years. Bitcoin is here for way, way longer than that.
Yeah, I think that speaks to that. I think that no state or company will actually be able to truly hold or hodl Bitcoin over long, long periods of time. They'll need it to spend, or to, it'll become cash flows. It'll be Bitcoin flows.
Yeah, they'll need to buy need to build a fucking cathedral that can stand for 2,000 years now, and like engrave the private keys somewhere in the catacombs or something, because they need to be much more long term thinking than they are now. Everyone needs to.
Right, but the only kind of state that's long-term thinking is like monarchy, and in a monarchy, like, I don't think the state actually owns the Bitcoin. The monarch.
No, the monarch would, and maybe would pass it down. But this is also a thing I've been talking about. Like, everyone gets to pass on wealth now for generations. So with these Bitcoins, we even have like, if you have more than one Bitcoin. Yeah, that will definitely be worth an astronomical sum in the for the next generation, and even it will be weird money for the generation after that, definitely. So what you can do is basically dub your children into little lords and ladies, and like add a von to your name or something. because you're basically doing what the feudal lords were doing when they started the whole thing, when feudalism started, because you're able to pass this power on through the generations.
Mm-hmm.
So get on dubbing people. Like, I'll start calling my son sir and stuff like that, sire, and my daughter lady.
Right. What's your favorite rabbit hole right now, even if it's outside Bitcoin? You know, like, what are you like looking at in terms of trying to acquire knowledge or scratch an itch?
It's a very good question. Well, objectivism is one rabbit hole.
How do you look at that?
I didn't really know it was a thing until I looked into it deeper. Of course, there are many worldviews that are like objectivism, but that really is struck a chord with me. And I would almost say that I'm an objectivist. So that's a rabbit hole. Well, what are other rabbit holes to look into? I mean, there's so many rabbit holes of Bitcoin. So I'm very,
which is your favorite one, which is or of the moment,
the latest article I'm working on is called "You Don't Get It and Neither Does Anyone Else." It's the next phrase, and it's about the weirdness of hyper-Bitcoinization and what it means and what it implies and where the vectors are pointing. I find hyper-Bitcoinization very fascinating, and I find the concept of blurring out the line between knowing and owning very, very fascinating, because in Bitcoin there's no difference between the two. Yeah, there are many, many rabbit holes to fall into.
I like the knowing and owning one. I've seen that a little bit in your work before, and it's really something I walk around the block and I have to think about that for a little bit. It changes things. Yeah, man. I love your work.
Thank you.
Yeah, this has been so incredible again. And I definitely want to have you back sometime. I got so many more questions and so many more topics we could dive into, but this has been so incredible. Definitely let everyone know where they could find you on Twitter and on Medium and whatnot. And those videos.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. I love these conversations, and you're such a great host. But this is one of my favorite pods in the entire space.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. That means a lot coming from you.
Yeah. And you can find me on Twitter at Knut Svanholm. I have my books. This is how they look.
I got them.
Yeah, you even got the first one there.
You don't talk about it enough, Knut. I like the first one. The second two are just phenomenal. I read them by the fireplace or outside at night. I really love these two.
I'm pretty proud of them. They are, but this year I've been working on articles mostly written for Citadel 21 magazine, and the latest one about the separation of money and state is in Bitcoin magazine, and I wrote for some other web page. 21ism, I wrote one for them. And I wrote one I wrote one called Free Money Isn't Money, which is a longer article. So if you haven't checked that out yet, you should.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't seen that one yet.
It's I wrote for a website called BitRawr, BitRawr.
Yeah, I think that was a big premise of what you were talking about with Jeff Booth on Princey's show. And I've heard you talk about this a little before, but just, money is increasingly more and more free to print and how it devalues everything else. And I'm looking forward to that article as well.
So
I have a feeling I'll read that and invite you back right away.
yeah, why not? Yes, and we're working on these videos with Yoni Appelberg and Guy Swan. Maybe you should, if you want me on again, maybe you should have me on with Guy and Yoni.
That sounds wild. Because I was just thinking about Yoni today.
Yeah, he's so underrated. I mean, he's a phenomenal animator.
Yeah.
And he's been doing videos of his own for years, and they're really good. And he's been collaborating with Jimmy Song and Saifedean and a lot of big names in Bitcoin. And I'm so happy to be working with him because, I get goosebumps every time I see one of his videos of my stuff for the first time. I mean, it's just thrilling to be doing this. Who would have thought?
Yeah, the videos are fantastic. I think that's a great idea. I'm going to shoot out an invite to the three of you right after this.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, we've never done anything as a trio in terms of interviews or stuff like that. And Yoni needs to get out more.
He does. Yeah. I'd like to hear from him. The videos are incredible. And the trifecta of talent involved really kind of gives some synergistic effects to it. So, this has been so incredible.
Yeah, and it keeps me on my toes. I need to I need to keep my writing really sharp just to
if I'm cooperating with those two guys, I really need to step up my game.
That's great. Okay. I think they just take your fantastic writing to another dimension, adding the audio and visual. Fantastic. It really just makes it three-dimensional, and some of the videos I share a lot, so really appreciate it. This has been incredible, Knut, so much.
Knut Svanholm, on bringing real digital value to the physical world, atheism, and the separation of money and state, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, make sure to subscribe, write a 5-star review, and share the link with your friends and family. Keep learning and keep stacking. This is Cedric. Peace.